birthday here. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
For the month of April, KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the recipient of the Community Tap Program at Hopworks Urban Brewery. Hopworks is donating 1% of all pint sale proceeds at all three pub locations to KBOO. They have locations at Southeast 29th and Powell, at North Williams and Shaver in Portland, and on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard in Vancouver, Washington. Thank you, Hopworks, for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland. For the month of April, KBOO Community Radio is...
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Southeast Mill...
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at the Northeast Whole Foods Market in Portland, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue. Local home birth midwives will show the film Why Not Home, followed by a QA session with the midwives. Again, that's Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at Whole Foods Market, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 8, it's Positively Revolting. Ani will speak with Kimberly McCullough, Policy Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and takes your calls. At 9, Beloved Community looks at the rising threats to free speech, Muslim-Christian dialogue, and LGBTQ advocacy. At 10, Valley Views talks to the Program Manager at Edible Corvallis Initiative at the Corvallis Environmental Center. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, the Digital Divide talks about Facebook testimony in front of Congress and internet privacy and our personal accountability. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Third Angle New Music and Hand to Mouth Theater, who present A Fond Farewell, reimagining the music of Elliott Smith. This collaboration will be at the Alberta Tonight. We'll be at the Alberta Tonight, Friday, April 13th. For more information, please visit www.thirdangle.org.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. It is about 4 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and this morning I am very excited to be having this conversation about Portland's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And we'll talk about what that is and what the implications of it are, as well as a campaign that is trying to end our participation in that task force. And we have in the studio with us to help us do just that thing, we have Kimberly McCullough, who is the policy director for the ACLU of Oregon. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we just want to jump straight into it because there is so much to talk about with this issue. Let's just start with the very basic. What is the Joint Terrorism Task Force?
Yeah, so the Joint Terrorism Task Force is essentially a collaboration between federal and local law enforcement. So it includes the FBI and Immigration and Customs Enforcement and several other federal agencies. And then they collaborate with local law enforcement on investigations, at least purportedly, of terrorism. And but what we unfortunately know is that those investigations have often targeted political protesters and have really involved spying and interrogation of activists, sort of based on fear that those folks may somehow be domestic terrorists.
And it really has these echoes of older programs that we swear were put to rest, right? Mm-hmm. COINTELPRO. Well, that was found unconstitutional. That doesn't happen anymore, except it keeps having these echoes, right, in new programs like the Joint Terrorism Task Force, where there's been some very serious issues with things that have happened around the labeling of potential threats and who is suspect.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's very interesting. So under the Constitution, we have a right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, right? And so that means
I've
the government.
That, yeah.
Yeah, imagine that. So the government should have to have some articulable suspicion, right, before they can start investigating us, collecting information about us. But what we know, unfortunately, is that the FBI operates under a much lower standard. In their own training materials, they basically say that there only needs to be a possibility of criminal activity before they start launching investigations into people based on, involvement of different political groups, based on religious beliefs, and all sorts of other things that we should be really protecting people for engaging in those activities.
Absolutely. And so Portland has this long history with our involvement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, first getting involved in the late 90s, actually. A lot of folks have the sort of misunderstanding that this partnership sort of evolved after 9/11, which is actually not true. Do you want to give a little history of how we got involved in this in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just to back up a little bit, when you asked me about what the JTTF is, I failed to mention that. So it was actually created in 1980.
Yeah.
And the city of Portland actually started its involvement prior to the year 2000. And it did that without any community input, without telling the public about it. And our organization, Copwatch, and a variety of our other allies, we became aware in 2000 that the city of Portland had this agreement with the JTTF. And so we started at that point raising really serious concerns. And so that, yeah, as you said, that was actually before 9/11. But then once 9/11 happened, our concerns were even, they were increased.
They were amplified a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, we warned the city of Portland that the FBI and the other federal agencies were likely to step up their use of those tactics that we were talking about that are inconsistent with the Oregon and the U.S. Constitution. And, and we were right. We know what happened after 9/11 and rounding up of people based on their religious beliefs and all sorts of unconstitutional tactics. So each year after the year 2000, as the Joint Terrorism Task Force, as their memorandum of understanding with the city and the JTTF, as that came up for review, a host of organizations, including ours, would go to city council and say, this is not okay. We have no oversight. We have no idea what's going on. These folks are operating under a different standard than we hold Oregon law enforcement and Portland law enforcement to stand up to. And finally, in 2005, the city of Portland heard our concerns. So at that point in 2005, they withdrew from formally participating in the JTTF. And we had a period of time there where we didn't participate. And then there was the Christmas tree attempted
yes.
bombing.
The Mohammed Mahmoud, who was, you know, some go as far as to say he was encouraged. He was certainly, his ideas were facilitated, mm-hmm. to say the least, in an FBI sting operation.
Yeah, that's right.
And so this was 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, again, if you're new to the area, this was a Christmas tree lighting ceremony downtown, and there was a young man who is now doing 30 years. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison for his part in this.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that story is just so interesting because, well, and really sad because his father actually was concerned about him and about his beliefs and actually contacted the authorities asking for help.
Right.
And instead of helping this young man, and, you know, I mean, in my ideal world, we would find folks who are thinking about engaging in violence and we would help get them the help they need and redirect them.
Exactly. That's what helping
right?
seems to be.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. But instead, you know, some folks might use the term entrapment, you know, where
I've heard that applied.
Yeah. So, you know, giving the person the tools and the resources, encouraging them to engage in an act of violence and then incarcerating them when they attempt to do that thing that you encouraged them to do. It's a very questionable and problematic tactic. And I think, you know, to me, it's based on sort of this idea that there are good people and there are bad people. We just got to catch the bad people.
Right.
And so we're going to catch them by encouraging them to do this bad thing
to
that we're going to do.
Right.
As opposed to that all people are really malleable and we have the capacity for really amazing things and really terrible things. And as a society, we should be trying to encourage us all to live up to our best potential. And I think that's the way that we would actually create community safety. So yeah, so
Kimberly, that's a wacky notion.
I know.
You know, to
that.
Actually, when say some group that is charged with public safety, which ostensibly, you know, the FBI mm-hmm. could be seen in that light, to have them step in and in fact intervene and say, mm-hmm. "Oh, here, you haven't done anything, you know, horrible. Let's actually do some education. Let's open up your mind to ideas like this. And if you're interested in self-expression and advocating for your community, here's some community leaders that you can talk to that can help to be role models because you're a very young person. I mean, we all know 19-year-olds. Yes, you can vote, but you still can't drink. You know, I mean, right. there's like we recognize that that's a period of life where the brain is forming, where mm-hmm. you are actually coming into adulthood. You may not have matured as a person yet, hence the, you know, 21 and over laws. It seems like that would have been a sort of fair sort of intervention. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it was more a facilitation of, oh, you got these ideas here. Here's how you can get some explosives.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we've seen the FBI use these tactics in a variety of different
we've
places.
We've certainly seen it during the 90s mm-hmm. in the environmental justice movements
yep.
Around the Arizona activists who were arrested for a thermite conviction. We've had Peg Millett, who was one of those activists on the show a number of times, talking about her experience of working with an FBI informant in their group who was just kind of perfect. He even liked to go country two-step dancing with her as he was telling them how to get the thermite and how to melt down power poles. Anyway,
yeah.
I digress, but we know that this is the actual history of the FBI.
That's right.
And why we don't necessarily trust them working with local law enforcement.
Yeah, and it's a bit strange that this operation happened in Portland
mm-hmm.
When we were not part of the JTTF.
Because there is nothing like a good scare tactic.
That's
I mean,
right.
Whoa, we almost had a Christmas tree car bombing
mm-hmm.
in downtown Portland. So suddenly, 6 months later, there was a unanimous vote on the city council. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So, yeah. So basically it came up for a vote again in 2011 and all of our organizations again went to city council and we were like, you know, this is not OK. And all of the same problems are going to be happening that we had identified before. It became clear, though, at that point that, you know, that this it had its own legs. It was gonna go forward, and so what they actually approved at that point was not full membership in the JTTF, but it was a case by case collaboration. So it was sort of a hybrid, mm-hmm. And understanding that this was going to happen, our organization basically we suggested a variety of provisions that were intended to try to do at least some damage control, so some sideboards, and provide at least some safeguards for the people of Portland. And the idea also being that it would create some transparency so folks would understand what was happening, and then perhaps we could have more conversations about with what was happening and if that was okay. So some of the safeguards that we included were that the Portland Police Bureau officers have necessary ongoing training on the differences between Oregon law and the guidelines issued by the U.S. Attorney General, because as I mentioned before, those are very, very different standards. And if Portland police officers are going to be participating in this task force, essentially wearing two hats, right? Yeah. They're a Portland police officer and they're also a JTTF member. We wanted to make sure that just wearing those two hats didn't mean that they suddenly are going to be violating Oregon law. And so they'd have to be trained on that. Also that there'd be a requirement that they notify the chief of police and the commissioner in charge of any violations of Oregon law, and that there would be this sort of public annual report to the city of Portland on what the Portland Police Bureau was up to with the JTTF with a series of questions. And so what we then saw was in 2012 and 2013 and 2014, each year that there was this required reporting, what we got back was not informative, not real answers to the questions that they were supposed to be answering. And you know, and this has happened in other cities, mm-hmm. where they've required some reporting from the JTTF. This is not unique to Portland. But we would go to city council every year and say this is grossly insufficient. There's no way to maintain oversight. And one of the things that we continued to really express concern about was the fact that the mayor of Portland did not have the proper clearance to be able to actually look into and verify what was actually happening. And so we encouraged the mayor to request that that enforcement or that information, so the clearance, so that he could see that information. And Mayor Hales requested that information. Actually, Sam Adams before him requested that clearance, and it was denied. And so what we found is was that this was just absolutely insufficient. But then in 2015.
Wait, it gets better.
Yeah, it gets better. Then, right. Then, you know, okay, so they're not reporting. They're not doing the things they're supposed to be doing. We have no oversight. We have no transparency. And then in 2015, the city essentially said, okay, well, we're going to just rejoin the JTTF in a full capacity, not on this case-by-case basis, and we're going to throw out all of these sideboards.
So since they weren't happening anyway, I mean, it's just cluttering up the place.
Yeah, so now what we have is full participation in the JTTF, no reporting, no oversight, no security clearance for the mayor, and now we have a new administration in the federal government. And we have increased enforcement by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And we see ICE engaging in all sorts of unconstitutional practices. And ICE is a member of JTTF. And so those of us who had been advocating on this issue for, you know, for a long time, or those of us at, you know, I've been at the ACLU for 3 years, so I wasn't around through all this history, but my organization was, and Dan Handelman from Cop Watch has been involved in this personally for many, many years. We basically were like, you know what, we need to revive this conversation. We need to start this conversation again and push the city to get out.
Absolutely. I want to invite our listeners to join in this conversation. It is of critical importance. We are here talking about Portland's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. My guest this morning is Kimberly McCullough. She is the policy director for the ACLU of Oregon. And we are taking your calls here at KABU. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Questions about what the Joint Terrorism Task Force is, what it does, and the campaign to end it. Please give us a call. You can also, just to let you know, follow along in the Twitterverse the entire week, because once a week is not enough to stay in touch with each other as, you know, as the world is burning. You can find us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. Also on Facebook, because, you know, why not just help the government spy on us? You can find us on Facebook, Positively Revolting, like our page there. You know, again, we keep the conversation going with every bit of media we can at our disposal throughout the week. So please do stay in touch and give us a call right now, 503-231-8187. I want to kind of skip forward and looking ahead to an event that's coming up next week. On Tuesday the 17th, there is a community forum discussing our involvement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, as well as the campaign to end it. Can you give us some details about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're pretty excited to have a guest join us who actually came out many years ago, actually. I think I was in law school, so I'm guessing, I don't actually remember what year it was, but it was sometime between 2010 and 2013. He came out before, and I actually got to attend the event, and it was really great. His name is Michael German. He is now a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. That's at New York University School of Law. And he has a very interesting history. So he actually used to work for the FBI, and he held himself to the standard that we expect with the Constitution, requiring reasonable suspicion or probable cause, depending on what type of intrusion sure. the government is engaging in. And while he was at the FBI, he became extremely concerned about practices that he saw overall at the FBI and about the standards that were starting to come down from the higher ups. And he decided to, he essentially was a whistleblower. He went and reported to Congress about it and faced some backlash from that as well internally at the FBI. So he ended up leaving the FBI in 2004. And at that point, he then joined the ACLU. So he worked for a national organization in our Washington legislative office as policy counsel for national security and privacy. So he really has a inside scoop of like what this actually looks like. And it's so interesting talking to him because, you know, he's also an expert on white supremacy and white supremacist groups and has done a variety of investigations into groups like that. And what he's basically said is when you start investigating people based on their beliefs, based on their religious beliefs, their political beliefs, you are creating a needle in a haystack situation. Mm-hmm. But when you actually hold yourself to a standard of, we're going to look for evidence that someone is actually engaged in some sort of harm, then you actually can identify who the folks are. And so he basically is like, you know, this is just absolutely incorrect the way that they're going about all of this. And so he can, you know, come and talk to us about that from that perspective. So he's going to talk for about a half hour, and then we're going to have a panel discussion after that. I'm going to be moderating the panel discussion. We'll be joined by Brandon Mayfield, who himself was a victim of targeting by the FBI it was the Madrid bombing.
It was the Madrid bombing, yeah.
Yeah, and he had absolutely nothing to do with it. And he went through a whole terrible ordeal of being targeted and questioned, and really had a really intense impact on him and his life.
I would imagine.
And so he has, you know, become an activist because of that. I mean, he already was a really wonderful member of our community. And doing lots of great things before that, but this has become a mission of his. Marlene Wallingford from the Japanese American Citizens League, there to really talk about the connection between this and our past history with the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And then Zakir, why am I forgetting Zakir's last name, from CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a really wonderful guy that can talk about, you know, more specifically about targeting based on religious beliefs.
Excellent. And Mayfield, just to get back to his case, which was just so egregious, he was actually arrested and held in custody. Again, on a completely just, it was a crazy premise. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is, again, what the government intrusion, what government spying and targeting has done in our communities. I mean, this is a man who is in our area, Washington County. And it's like, you know, when it happens, we see clearly it can happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is part of the dangers that certainly we've talked about over and over on Positively Revolting. Dan Handelman has been a frequent guest over the last 18 years talking about the JTTF. When we see cases like Brandon Mayfield's, it underscores exactly how important it is to stay on top of the issue and to really, you know, I want to say at least get the oversight, but since we see that that's not possible, let's end this really toxic relationship, right? So can you talk a little bit more about the campaign to end it and what the ACLU is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we have you know, I don't actually know what the number of organizations that we have now. Dan would know. If you look on the Peace and Justice Works website, we have a letter that we sent to City Council.
It's over 20.
It's over 20. It is. But definitely includes Copwatch, ACLU, the JACL, as I mentioned before, CARE, the League of Women Voters, and a variety of other organizations. And basically, we started the campaign back in November and went and spoke to City Council. We have been meeting with City Council members and talking to them about it with their staff members, and, you know, really encouraging them to do the right thing here. Mike German and I will actually go and speak to City Council again on Wednesday morning after, next Wednesday morning, so the morning after we have our forum. We have invited City Council members and their staff to attend that event as well. So hopefully some of them show up. We also put an action alert out on our website. And if people are interested in signing up for that, if you go to aclu-or.org, you can find our action alert system. You can put your email in to sign up for action alerts, but you can also find the action alert specifically on this Joint Terrorism Task Force, and it'll essentially send a letter from you by email to all of the City Council members. And the other thing that we've been doing is encouraging folks to ask the candidates for office for Portland City Council what their position is now, and there is a survey that has been distributed to them. We will have the responses to that survey at the event on Tuesday, and you know, the different forums that are happening, we're really encouraging questions to really get folks to start thinking about this, to state their position, so that the people of Portland know, you know, what their position is before they actually get voted into office. Our concern is that we don't seem to see movement on City Council right now, and so it may be that we have to wait till the new City Council comes in to actually get the change here. And I should also mention that, you know, our organizations in our specific campaign, we aren't the only folks in Portland who have concerns about the JTTF. Portland Resistance actually has been also independently putting out a lot of pressure on city council and raising this issue up, really doing some great grassroots activism on the issue. And they actually had their own petition that they put out right around the same time that we did our action alert. So there really is a broad range of folks who are concerned about this and who are putting the pressure on. And so hopefully, you know, we see a change here, and we see it soon.
Right. You know, and it's just, again, it's essential. So I want to encourage your participation in the show this morning. Go ahead and give a call into the studio at 503-231-8187. The archive of the show will be posted to the KBOO website. You can find it there, kboo.fm/positivelyrevolting. And you can see the archive of this show later on this morning, as well as all of the programs we've done in the past, including last week's show with Dan Handelman, as we talked about police violence and many other topics. But definitely looking at the police violence endemic in our system. And then I couldn't help but notice it was in the very next day that the Portland police killed another person. And so, again, staying on top of these issues, these are critical issues in our times. These are not sort of the side things that we can sort of gloss over as we work on whatever else we are working on. These issues are part and parcel with any other struggle we are participating in, because, in fact, the behavior of the Portland police and the security community, let's just say, really impact each and every one of us on a daily basis, especially as we look at the history of COINTELPRO and by any other name, right? I mean, it's these sorts of chilling surveillance programs have, you know, they've changed name and nomenclature over decades because they sort of get found out about and get a bad rep and occasionally get slapped down by a court system somewhere saying that they're unconstitutional. So they just sort of grow another head, rename themselves, and come back like the Hydra they are. Please give us a call. Join in the conversation. 503-231-8187. This is Positively Revolting. You're listening to us on KBOO, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and this morning my guest is Kimberly McCullough. She is the policy director for the ACLU of Oregon. I want to also let you know that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, the beloved community is looking at rising threats to free speech, Muslim-Christian dialogue, and the LGBTQ plus advocacy work. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views talks to the program manager at Edible Corvallis Initiative at the Corvallis Environmental Center. At 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Digital Divide talks about Facebook testimony in front of Congress, internet privacy, and our own personal accountability. We want to thank KBOO members for your generous support. You keep us all grassroots, and that's crucial to keeping us independent and strong so we can keep bringing you people's media. To keep informed and to get involved, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You can become a member right now. Let's go ahead and take a caller. Again, that number is 503-231-8187. Join us on the air. We have about another 25 minutes or so, so jump on in. Shabbat, you are on the air.
Good morning, Ani. Thank you for having a great show as usual.
Thank you.
I just wanted to do a small plug for the subject. We have a great candidate for our city council that would bring great oversight to the police, and that would be Joanne Hardesty. Please remember her and get involved behind her. And that's all I have to say. Keep up with the great show. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your call this morning. You know, I think that this is a wonderful moment, actually, in Portland's history where we actually have two council positions open, and it's a great time to ask those candidates what their activities have been like around the JTTF, as well as what their policies will be like in the future. Thanks for that comment. And again, 503-231-8187, the number to call, to remind folks about Tuesday's forum. Again, that's at the Maranatha Church,
That's right.
And that's next Tuesday, the 17th. It's a community forum. And if you are interested in staying informed and on top of this issue, and why wouldn't you be? it would be a great place to connect and get more information. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. We hope that we get a good crowd.
And as you were just saying, that you will hopefully have the results of the surveys of the city council candidates.
That's
that
right.
Time. So
yeah.
That can be a topic of discussion there as well.
Absolutely.
Cool. I know the other thing I wanted to do is, again, just mention other ways that we can stay in touch with each other throughout the week. As my tongue ties, I don't know. It happens sometimes. But please do. You can follow us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. Positive Revolt. You can also find us on Facebook, Positively Revolting. So there's actually a caller right now who is asking us to give all of those details for the Tuesday night gathering again. So that, again, is this Tuesday evening. I also got to say it's posted to our website here at KABU. But that is Tuesday evening at the Maranatha Church.
That's right, and it's at 7 o'clock.
And that's with Mike German and local activists who are also surveying this issue, yeah?
Yep, that's right.
And where is the Maranatha Church? I should have that address memorized by now, but I don't seem to.
And I should have it also.
Oh, my goodness. We should.
We can make that happen.
Momentarily, I swear. And this is me playing for time as I'm looking up the address. Ah!
Me too. Okay, here we go. It's on Northeast 12th Avenue. So it is 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue here in Portland.
And that's, again, 7 o'clock. Tuesday evening, April 17th, a community forum that is being put together by Portland Comp Watch, by the ACLU, and by other interested groups, let's just say.
Yeah, and we do have a Facebook event, so if folks are interested, they can go to the ACLU's ACLU of Oregon's Facebook or to Cop Watch.
They don't have a Facebook.
They're smart. or any of our other organizations, JACL has a Facebook, and we all have the event posted. And please feel free to invite your friends.
Absolutely. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And you too can get involved in this conversation. We have just about 20 minutes left. So please do jump on in, because you know what happens when you wait to that last minute. Everyone sort of tries to jam in at once and it doesn't work. So call on in with your comments, with your questions about this critical issue of Portland's involvement in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So how many, nationwide, it's not just like this is a thing that happened in Portland.
Yeah.
Is this, how many other areas have JTTFs?
I don't know the full number, but I know that it's a lot.
Okay.
And I know that there are other cities in Oregon that have the JTTF. I know that for example, when I was reviewing some of our older files for having this interview today, I noticed that we'd been engaged with Lake Oswego and trying to have conversations with them about getting out of the JTTF. And when I've looked nationally, there's all sorts of different cities really across the country. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because we also have, this is a slightly different topic, but we have a sort of different version of this at the state level with our the Titan Fusion Centers, which is a collaboration between our State Department of Justice and federal agencies as well. So I'm glad you actually brought that up because
that actually is my next question, is what connection does this have with the fusion centers, which again has been a topic of conversation years past on KABU, but we haven't really talked about it so recently.
Right. Well, part of the problem here is that because all of these things operate under such a veil of secrecy, it's really hard for us to know what the communication is between all of these different entities. But the fusion centers are essentially the sort of state level version of the JTTF, where you have federal entities that are collaborating and sharing information with state government. And you know, it's interesting because what we know is that that can cause that can cause problems, and that the federal government and their sort of encouragement of state entities to engage in these practices where they're targeting people based on their political and religious beliefs, that can really have a big impact on the way that those state and local entities operate. And a great example of that actually was the investigation that happened of Arias Johnson, the head of the Civil Rights Division of our State Department of Justice. The thing that actually started that. So just for folks who don't know,
please.
The State Department of Justice was trying out essentially, you know, a new tool that was using the social media monitoring software, which essentially trolls social media for apparent threats of, you know, so that they can figure out who's dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of problems to trying to do that through algorithms and all of that. But anyway, they were trying out this new tool. They hadn't purchased it yet. And one of the agents at the Department of Justice decided to search for folks that had been posting about Black Lives Matter. Now, the reason that they thought that folks engaged in activities related to Black Lives Matter or even posting about it were dangerous was because of a bulletin they had received from the federal government that had been distributed to law enforcement all across the country, essentially labeling Black Lives Matter as a domestic terrorist organization and saying, you know, got to watch out for these guys. And you know, it's just absolutely ridiculous. Those of us who believe Black Lives Matter are not domestic terrorists. We're actually people with a very valid point and valid political beliefs. And it's really scary to think, oh, if I post about Black Lives Matter, the government might be watching me.
Right.
And that certainly has a chilling effect on our First Amendment rights.
Absolutely. And again, this is something that we have seen over and over again. In the early aughts, I remember reading ad nauseum that the animal liberation movements were the number one, domestic terror threat. You know, at the same time, abortion clinics receive live bombs and shooters.
Right.
So again, the political framing, the ideological framing of who is heavily monitored and who isn't, really has everything to do with a chilling effect and keeping the status quo.
That's absolutely right.
And doesn't seem to have a whole lot to do with who's actually posing viable threats.
Yeah, in fact, the ACLU of Oregon, ourselves, have been the target of investigations. In the ACLU, throughout our history, if you go back to McCarthyism, being a card-carrying member of the ACLU was like, that was very...
that was damning in and of its own right.
Exactly.
Look, you are interested in protecting your civil liberties. There must be something going on.
That's right. But we actually, you know, we found, it was in the 70s and 80s, found that the ACLU of Oregon had actually been under investigation by the Portland Police Bureau, and that they were keeping files on us. And you know, that actually brings me to another subject, which I just think is interesting, which is that we launched a part of the reason that we got out of the JTTF in 2005 was because the ACLU launched a FOIA. FOIA request campaign where we filed Freedom of Information Act requests to the FBI and then also local public records requests to the city of Portland, to Portland Police Bureau, to try to get files on, find out what they had been doing and what they had been investigating. And, you know, when I started my job, our former executive director, Dave Fidanke, one of the first things he did was come in my office and take these heavy files and set them down in my office and say, just so you know, these are actually the FBI's files on the ACLU of Oregon from, there were two sets of them that they had requested. And, you know, it was just like ridiculous. It was like newspaper clippings of like, oh, they're having a forum on some topic, or, oh, they've got an opinion about something. And, you know, they're just collecting all of this information that was really very useless if you're actually trying to do a criminal investigation, because it was just, what are our political activities?
Right.
And it was because of discovering that the Portland Police Bureau and the FBI had been engaged in all of those things that Oregon actually passed a couple of really important laws. One of them in particular, it was originally ORS 181.575, but it got renamed recently, which is always confusing. It's now ORS 181.250. It is a very unique state law, and it was the first of its kind, and as far as I know, the only of its kind in the entire country. What it does is it prohibits state and local law enforcement from collecting or maintaining records on the political, religious, or social activities of individuals or organizations in the state of Oregon. So basically what that says is the government cannot target you for investigation based on those things. It can't collect information. So, you know, a great example of like what that might look like is you know, sitting outside of a church or a mosque and taking photographs of who's going in and out, or keeping records of who shows up at what protest. And so we have this state law that actually prohibits that. We also have, you know, a state sanctuary law, which says that our state and local government can't participate in immigration enforcement. And then the other law that we have that's really great is anti-profiling legislation. And what that requires, it was passed in 2015, HB 2002, which was then the Center for Intercultural Organizing, but now Unite Oregon. Mm-hmm. They were kind of the lead organization, and we had a really broad coalition of organizations that got that passed. But it prohibits profiling by state and local law enforcement. And so that would be, you know, based on your race, immigration status. It actually is a really expansive list of protected classes in there. It includes homelessness, we know that our homeless population are targeted frequently for suspicion of criminal activities simply because they're homeless.
Yeah.
So we have all of these really great state laws. That's, again, why we don't want participation in the JTTF, because those standards are really high standards that we hold our government to, and the FBI and the JTTF, they don't follow those standards.
They seem to have an entirely different set of standards.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, the idea of occasionally I do hear from people, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why does it matter if the government like looks at what you look at on the internet?
Boy.
If you're not doing anything wrong, if you don't have anything to hide,
mm-hmm.
right? What's wrong with that argument?
Oh my goodness, there's.
I know
much,
we only have 10 minutes.
There's
but
so much wrong with that argument.
Yeah.
You know, so first of all, we all do have something to hide.
Yeah.
This may be a little bit crass, but one of my good friends from law school used to always make the joke, and it's not really a joke, but say the statement that, you know, I don't have anything illegal in my underwear drawer, but I don't want the government rifling through it, right?
We
have private stuff. Everybody has private stuff. Is it your medical records? Is it whether or not you're going to drug treatment? Is it what your relationships are? Who you're dating? Is it what church you go to? Sure, there are things about ourselves that we want to share, but we want to be the ones that get to share it or not share it. The other thing is, there may be people in the world that really just don't care, and that's fine. But for those people to say, it doesn't matter to me, and so therefore no one should have privacy, that's like a really antisocial thing to say, right?
Yeah.
I think we should care about what other people in our community care about, right? We should care about the fact that it matters to them. So if I don't care about, say, for example, the privacy of what's in my garbage can, but my neighbor does, I should honor the fact that they do want that privacy. Our privacy is super important as well, so that we can actually engage in freedom of association and freedom of speech, right? So if we want to be politically active, but our beliefs are unpopular, say, for example, the government is targeting folks who have particular political beliefs, you know, we want to be able to have people be able to get together and have conversations and have the safety to be able to express themselves and be able to explore their ideas.
Right.
That's a crucial part of our democracy. If we just suppress all of that, then all sorts of bad things happen. It's like a pressure cooker, you know, and right. and you're not letting any of the steam out right. by not letting people express themselves, and all sorts of bad things can happen.
For sure. And I think it's also just looking at the chilling effect, which is real.
Yep.
And when we, again, you know, just sort of continuing your theme, when we stifle any kind of resistance, mm-hmm. you know, to a system that can sorely use some changing, what are we doing? You know, yep. what is that? What's the ultimate message there?
Yeah.
You know, Michael German, actually, there's a great article that is... in the News and Observer, something I'm not really all that familiar with, I have to admit. But I, you know, followed some links, and I did find this article that German is quoted in. And I'm just going to go ahead and give this quote because I think it does underscore a lot. Michael German sees the depiction of radicalization put forth by the FBI as misleading. He says, in most cases, it's far more likely to see it's far more likely these terrorists are individuals already planning violent action, looking for an ideology to pin it on. And he goes on to say, he's comparing the Omar Mateen, the Orlando shooter who killed 49 people in 2016 at the gay nightclub, who pledged, Omar Mateen pledged allegiance to ISIS, to James Holmes, the Aurora shooter who killed 12 people in 2012 at a movie screening of The Dark Knight Rises. Mateen's attack was seen as an obvious ideological attack against gay people, while no one, and this is a quote from German, no one is suggesting that Holmes was motivated by hatred for Batman or anyone else watching him. And this is sort of that sharp divide between if the powers that be can possibly tie somebody in with radical extremists, especially Muslim radical extremists, mm-hmm. then this is what hits the headlines. Otherwise, it's these lone wolves. It's these lonely white guys that just are angry and don't know how to deal with their emotions very well.
Right.
And there's a lot of political motivation behind these labels, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that is probably my knack for British understatement. That these the way that we characterize and the way that we profile, the way that law enforcement profiles is obviously not making us safer, but it is actually creating a very chilling political climate.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I find it really is deeply disturbing that we've seen this repeat itself. As you mentioned, you know, COINTELPRO and all of these, I think you called it a hydra,
yes.
these things just repeating themselves over and over and over again. It's kind of a tried and true tactic of folks in power to try to maintain their power by discrediting folks who disagree with them by accusing them of somehow being criminal, when really what they're actually doing is just disagreeing with their political beliefs. Yeah. And, you know, I do dream of a world where we can have folks that have a really broad variety of different political ideas, and we can engage with each other and try to tease out the way that we want our society to be without using these really, really underhanded tactics. And yeah. I think, you know, there are places in the world where they don't engage in surveillance like the United States does, and that they don't engage in these tactics of prying into people's lives and setting people up to commit crimes and you know, all of these
giving them the instruction manuals to commit
exactly
the crimes.
And and you know, we do know that there are places in the world that don't do those things, and in fact, you know, many of those places have lower violence rates than we do in the United States.
So
that's actually a sort of a broader thing that I think is, you know, we have these conversations about why do we have so much violence in the United States, and to me, when you have a government that elevates violence and elevates these sort of really awful yeah. tactics, and they hold that up as the standard,
yep.
it's kind of no wonder that sort of infects the society and creates creates this sort of really, really negative environment where mm-hmm. people engage in really bad activities.
Yeah, there's so much to say on that.
I mean, that's
another hour entirely.
Oh, it sure is.
And and we are almost out of time, but Linda is joining us. Good morning, Linda. You're on the air.
Good morning for the show and all the information.
For sure.
I wanted to bring up these Oregon laws and the fact that we have a fusion center in Wilsonville and one in Salem, mm-hmm. and they use the fusion centers. All types of law enforcement in Oregon have representatives at the mm-hmm. fusion center. They're not always there, based there, but they are to the fusion center. And this summer, this last summer in June, when Portland police kettled a group of people in a demonstration united against fascism, at the end they kettled people and they took their pictures with their driver's licenses held up next to their faces. My understanding is those photos and that information goes into the fusion center as a contact made, and that the fusion center does not later purge those. State level, the state says at state level we purge anything after 2 years, but if it goes in through the fusion center, that goes into federal records that are accessible by any of over 40 other fusion centers,
mm-hmm.
and as high as NORTHCOM, it goes through all of the federal kinds of law enforcement. So how is our Oregon law protecting us against that kind of capture of our legal right to demonstrate?
I'm so glad that you called this morning, Linda. I well remember the shows that you've done on the fusion centers, and thank you for your work in this area.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and I think that what you've identified there is exactly the reason why the state should not be participating in the fusion centers if they don't meet our standards of Oregon law. And that our local government here in Portland shouldn't be engaging in the JTTF if the JTTF doesn't meet our standards. Because you're exactly right that if we hold our local and state government accountable, right, that they can't engage in these activities, but they can just pass that information off to the feds. And then the feds can do whatever they want and then pass that information back to the state and local government, right? So maybe they're not holding it on the state side, but it's accessible to the folks on the state side, then it's essentially a backdoor. It's getting around all of our local regulations. And so I think that you've identified exactly the problem.
Yeah. It's particularly problematic since they do appear to focus on legal political activity rather than on something that might lead to terrorism, because we know I have emails that were redacted but show clearly that the fusion center in McMinnville was involved in surveilling the Occupy movement and coming to decisions mm-hmm. that we made about the Occupy movement here. And then we know about Black Lives United. So it seems to focus, that to me, I believe that is the purpose of these fusion centers, is actually to prevent domestic dissent. But and that's what they're there for, but they're not. If they don't have that as a stated purpose, and we as a community and as a country don't agree with that purpose, I'm really happy that you guys are starting this campaign to get rid of them.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for your call this morning, Linda.
Yeah, thank you.
And we have just about 1 minute left, literally. Bill, you are on the air for a very quick comment.
Okay. Supporting the chief of police, Danielle Outlaw, for telling her agency that they cannot work from the secret list related to gang members. Because going back to the Black Panthers and even the 80s in the whole gang movement, what we found is these secret lists really don't add up to much other than creating criminals in many cases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just want the community to come out and support the fact that there is actually a chief of police who are saying we need to do something, or we need to find a way to work within the system, but not like this.
All right, Bill, thank you very much for your very quick comment here at the end of the show. Take care. And final thoughts, Kimberly.
Oh, thank you so much for this great discussion. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and really fantastic comments by the callers. And just really want to encourage everyone to sign up for our action alerts at aclu-or.org and go get on our website and Take a look for the action alert here on the JTTF. Contact your city council members, encourage them. And if you have any contact with candidates for office, please ask them their position and try to get them to do the right thing.
We will actually be having a candidates forum on air here next Wednesday morning. I believe that's at 9. Stay tuned for more details on that. And stay informed. Again, Tuesday night is the forum, community forum, on why Portland should get back out of the terrorism task force. That is at the Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th at 7 o'clock. That's with Michael German and many others. And we'll be back next week talking about the valve turners and the movement to stop the tar sands project. All right, take care and stay involved.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host a class, Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m. here at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally, nationally, and at KBOO. We'll explore how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, and how rhyme writing, production, and liberation struggles have contributed to hip hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m., KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come on, play some blues now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. For the past 7 years, the Inner City Blues Festival has focused on healing the healthcare blues, supporting Oregon's universal healthcare movement. Performers this year include the Norman Sylvester Review with Sarah Billings and Leanne Miller, the King Louis Payne Quartet and LaRonda Steele, and many, many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue at Lombard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.